The Iran nuclear deal is essentially dead, but America now faces multiple aggressive adversaries around the globe. This is Brief Before Impact. Hey, welcome everyone. I am Matt Parker, and thank you for joining me. Today's brief is going to be discussing the famed Iran nuclear deal and how it's essentially is, according to our President Joe Biden, it is now dead. We're going to talk about the problems of the deal and its formation, as well as how Russia has been involved in recent years and how that is quickly dissolving due to their war in Ukraine. And lastly, we'll highlight just some big picture threats to the United States and how, despite this, the goals of the Iran deal, that the problems abroad from a short to near term and longer term out between our adversaries will continue to press America into dealing with these threats in many different ways. We'll go through all this. Just let me take a quick ad break and then we will get to work. Welcome back, everyone. So let me just highlight some reporting from Brett Schaefer, writing for the Heritage Foundation, discussing the problems with the Iran nuclear deal. The Biden administration continues to push the myth that the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, or otherwise known as the Iran nuclear deal, was a success in restraining Iran's nuclear program. In the words of the State Department spokesman Ned Price, it provided a permanent mechanism to ensure that Iran is never able or allowed to acquire nuclear weapons. Secretary Anthony Blinken recently reiterated this view, blaming Iran's nuclear progress on the Trump administration's decision to pull out of the deal. Quote, "Before the previous administration unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA, Iran's nuclear program was in a box. Iran was abiding by its commitments under the agreement. Its nuclear program was the most rigorously monitored and verified in history. The breakout time needed for Iran to acquire enough fissile material to produce a nuclear weapon had been extended to more than a year. In short, the JCPOA was working," end quote. So these statements are deceptive at best, designed to justify the administration's failed and imprudent overtures to Tehran. The truth is that the JCPOA was not designed to be a permanent mechanism. It included multiple sunset clauses that ensured sanctions would expire at steady intervals until 2031. Even Iran's commitment to allow International Atomic Energy Agency monitoring and verification under the JCPOA would expire by 2040. In short, even if Tehran had abided by the agreement, the JCPOA would not have prevented Iran from pursuing a nuclear program down the road. Under the terms of the JCPOA, Iran would have eventually been permitted to produce highly enriched uranium, use advanced centrifuges, and conduct other activities necessary for it to produce a nuclear weapon. Former President Obama even acknowledged that toward the end of the timeline enshrined in the JCPOA, Iran could use the advanced centrifuges that enrich uranium fairly rapidly. And at that point, the breakout times would have shrunk almost down to zero, end quote. Thus, the shorter breakout times about which Secretary Blinken expressed concern would at best have been delayed rather than prevented by the deal. Now, the fact is, the JCPOA is inadequate. The best that it could be said of it is that it slowed the development of Iran's nuclear exchange, or at least the development of the program's known elements. But in return for that temporary slowdown, it gave Tehran a front-loaded package of financial benefits, resources that have subsequently been used to support regional terrorism and domestic repression. And if the best that it could be said of the JCPOA is that it slowed down the development of Iran's nuclear program, then it was a failure by President Biden's own standards. Biden has vowed to never allow Iran to have a nuclear weapon, even as he presses on with an effort to revive the JCPOA that directly undermines that objective. So under the JCPOA, the ability to reimpose UN sanctions is set to expire in 2025. And once that happens, you know, good luck getting the Security Council at the United Nations to adopt new resolutions sanctioning Iran, even if it openly pursues a nuclear program, because Iran is supplying Russia with drones for its war in Ukraine. Russia a permanent member of the Security Council, would inevitably veto any such attempt. So this is the challenge that the JCPOA has dealt with more in its formation, the way it was created in the first place. And this kind of speaks more broadly to how different administrations handle these types of adversaries, particularly to their goal to pursue nuclear weapons. Iran is a unique thorn in the Middle East. And if you look back, the Obama administration using the JCPOA to, with its goal to prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons, the problem is the way it was designed was never going to allow that to happen. President Trump, in his view, recognized that this wasn't the best deal for the United States, therefore he just pulled out of it and decided to pursue other types of ways to slow down Iran, sanctions and the such. In addition to that, as President Biden took office, immediately trying to revive the JCPOA, this is, to me, again, reflects the challenge for the executive branch in the United States, as from especially anything that's not done through a legislative process. You have this kind of drastic shifting back and forth from an Obama type of philosophy to a Trump back to a Biden. It, in my view, would make it very challenging, especially for our allies abroad, to understand the overall direction the United States is going. And certainly, between those three administrations, there was continuity in regard in a handful of issues. For example, the issue of that China that Trump has, I thought, did a tremendous job of bringing to the world and creating essentially a trade war with them. Biden has essentially continued on without changing at all. So there is that, to a degree, some continuity between some of these issues. But it's those dramatic shifts that I imagine our allies are frustrated by, because it doesn't really know how long it can depend on the United States to follow through with any of the deals that one administration creates. So in the fact, and now that you understand the kind of the JCPOA, it's dying and it's on its last legs, and it was really never meant to prevent Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon. How does Russia intertwine with the negotiations and the dealings of Iran when it comes to this deal? Well, Russia's position on Iran's nuclear program has always lagged behind its confrontation with the West. Before the invasion of Ukraine, Moscow actively supported diplomatic efforts to curb Iran's nuclear ambitions. And this is according to Hannah Note, writing for War on the Rocks. After the invasion, Russia initially disrupted these efforts, but soon reverted to a more neutral stance. Now, with Moscow being ever more dependent on Tehran for economic and battlefield support, Russia's attitude will likely become increasingly unhelpful. This is bad news for the United States. Efforts to restore the Iran nuclear deal, and bad news for the cause of global non-proliferation more broadly. Throughout 2021, Russia actively encouraged the restoration of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Towards that end, Russia diplomats mediated between its parties, averted a breakdown in Iran's relations with the International Atomic Energy Agency on several occasions, and evenly publicly reprimanded Iran on its breaches and delays in returning to the negotiating table. With the invasion of Ukraine, Russia ceased to push for meaningful and timely progress in the nuclear talks or to insulate them from broader geopolitical tensions. Amid heightened tensions with the West, Moscow's growing ties with Tehran are producing both the Kremlin's ability and willingness to nudge Iran towards accepting a renewed nuclear deal or to publicly criticize Iran. Now, the invasion of Ukraine changed Russia's calculations on the desirability of seeing the nuclear deal restored, probably not all at once, but certainly as the ripple effects of the invasion became more apparent. On March 5th, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov stated that for the first time that Western sanctions imposed against Russia over the war in Ukraine had become a stumbling block for the nuclear deal, warning that a Russian national interest would have to be taken into account. Lavrov proceeded to demand written guarantees from the United States that Russia's trade, investment, and military technical cooperation with Iran would not be hindered in any way by such sanctions. Now, there's the risk that Russia's attitude towards non-proliferation more broadly might be changing. Historically, Moscow always defended Iran's right to peaceful nuclear energy and routinely sought to limit UN sanctions on Iran. But Russian leaders never wanted Iran to weaponize its nuclear program, let alone become a nuclear weapon state. Today, it cannot be ruled out that Russia, set on a total collision course with the West, might view Iran's nuclear hedge as a welcomed irritant to distract the West. While the current Russian leadership would still prefer Iran not to get a bomb, it might see Tehran's nuclear hedge as more useful than worrisome at this time, particularly as Iran has moved down the Kremlin's list of perceived threats in recent years. The Kremlin prefers protracted uncertainty over the fate of the JCPOA to either a successful deal or its formal collapse. But should it prove impossible to continue diplomacy after the U.S. midterm elections, and should Western states declare the deal dead, which they have, by the way, Russia will likely try to protect Iran against any consequences. It will probably shield Tehran in the UN Security Council, attempt to complicate Western efforts to snap back UN sanctions, and provide Iran more advanced air defense systems and other weapons. Such steps will undoubtedly put Moscow further at odds not only with the Western capitals, but also Israel and the Arab states of the Persian Gulf. But from Moscow's perspective, Russia cannot afford to leave Iran out in the cold as it continues its struggle with the West. So you can see here how that recent invasion of Ukraine has sincerely changed the kind of outlook that Russia has had historically to Iran acquiring a nuclear weapon, where before it was like, absolutely not. Now it's, well, maybe it's possible that Iran with a nuclear weapon could be enough of a distraction that the West would weaken its resolve against Russia and allow it to take Ukraine as it has been trying to do for the last year. This is additionally the challenge when the West has imposed these dramatic sanctions on Russia. Dramatic meaning so severe is probably the better word. And so severe that it has tied to now turn to Iran for military cooperation, assistance for hardware and different weapons for the war. This again reiterates the point that it's a multipolar world where so many countries depend on one another for different aspects to survive. And whenever you can put all that into the frame of working together at the United Nations, this is why so rarely does anything that comes out of the United Nations, any type of agreement that the United States comes with its partners abroad, is it then going to find its way back to the United States Senate for any kind of approval or certainly any type of meaningful legislation out of the Congress? This is because while American leaders and its ambassadors are attempting to work with their counterparts around the world at the United Nations, that work often doesn't represent the values of some of the members of our Congress representing their own constituents. So though you have America stepping into these very broad-scale agreements, they won't ever get ratified in the United States because so many elected leaders don't see those agreements as truly representing the interests of their people that have put them in office in the first place. Again, this is how you see such dramatic shifts between one administration to the next. So with that outline of the JCPOA and how Russia's intertwined into it, let me highlight just the big picture of the, as especially in the context, as Russia has invaded Ukraine, how things have shifted for America's view towards all the different threats, short, medium, and long term, that now the United States faces. This is according to Raphael Cohen, writing for War on the Rocks. Underlying the shift to a one-war force is a big strategic bet, namely that U.S. adversaries are internally divided and therefore unlikely to launch wars simultaneously. For a time, the premise seemed reasonable. China and Russia, after all, fought a war against one another. China and Russia also joined the West in negotiating a deal to curb Iran's nuclear program. North Korea and Iran are half a world apart. Even relations between China and North Korea have been strained at times. Moreover, each of the adversaries appeared to operate on different timelines. Iran and North Korea seem to be the most immediate threats, given the former's ongoing proxy war activity and the latter's regular missile and nuclear test. While Russia, at least prior to February 2022, and China pose longer-term challenges. Even the most recent 2022 National Defense Strategy includes some of the sequential thinking. China is the pacing challenge, while Russia is merely an acute or short-term one. And if threats only reared up sequentially, then the United States could reasonably assume that it would only need to tackle one adversary in one theater at a time. But the geopolitical winds are changing. For starters, American adversaries are increasingly militarily intertwined. Russia has long been in the arms business, selling air defense systems to Iran and aircraft engines to China, among other items. Today, though, the relationships are more bidirectional. Iran gave drones and North Korea shipped artillery shells to Russia to support its war in Ukraine. China supplied Iranian proxies with drones. North Korea proliferated missile technology to Iran and potentially offered its nuclear know-how as well. Military cooperation between American adversaries now goes beyond mere weapon sales. Iran and Russia supposedly colluded on the response to the Syrian civil war, coordinating their military activities in the country. More recently, Iran provided advisors to assist Russia in using its drones in Ukraine. In return, Tehran has reportedly asked Moscow for help quelling protest. As National Security Council spokesman John Kirby said recently, Russo-Iranian ties are deepening into a full-fledged defense partnership. Meanwhile, China and Russia have said that their friendship has no limits. While China only has offered tepid support for Russia in its war in Ukraine, Beijing still has an interest in deepening military ties with Moscow. In fact, Chinese leader Xi Jinping has, at least in some estimations, doubled down on his relationship with Russia. The two have conducted multiple joint bomber patrols and participated in military exercises with much fanfare. And the timelines for each of these threats are accelerating. Iran now regularly engages in low-level military aggression, including missile attacks near American diplomatic facilities. North Korea has hit another record year of missile tests. Russia is fighting a war in Ukraine as threatened nuclear war. And the timeline for a potential Chinese invasion of Taiwan may have accelerated. Consequently, it is no longer implausible that more than one threat would bubble up at once. Indeed, several seem to already be bubbling. Looking ahead, then, the premise that the United States will only need to fight one adversary in one part of the world seems like a bad bet. The United States may not yet be confronting a true axis of evil, but American adversaries are becoming more tightly aligned, leaving the United States with a one-war force for an increasingly multi-war world. And as we've recognized that our adversaries are more intertwined, I think just recognizing the shifts in our own national defense policy that the individuals in D.C. creating the policy are aware of this multi-war world and trying to produce our defense capabilities making them able to actually defend against it. For so long, or 20 plus years, we're just focused on counterterrorism, which is its own specific unique threat. But back in 2014, when Obama shifted its focus to the Pacific, looking at threats in China and North Korea, we began to see Pentagon resources and policies geared more towards that near-peer competition. And now, with our adversaries working together on different aspects of providing hardware and weapons to one another, it seems like this is the time more than ever to double down on our bilateral, multilateral relationships with our allies abroad in order to pose, to stop these regional threats before they get blown up into a full-fledged war. And I say regional threats because when you're looking at an American policy to ensure that Iran or North Korea or Russia doesn't even create a massive scale war where it's killing millions of people. You have to get buy-in from the regional powers there. You know, for example, we've obviously seen Russia and Ukraine context, European powers such as Germany, for example, just totally shifting their policies for both energy and militarily due to that regional threat of Russia and its war shifting over further west into Europe. If we focus on Iran, for example, to curb Iran, President Trump went about the Abraham Accords, getting buy-in from all these regional leaders to have a unified defense front against Iran and its potential nuclear threat. If shifting even further east to the issue of China invading Taiwan or even North Korea, enhancing that relationship with our partners such as like Australia, New Zealand, Japan, allows for these regional actors to have more, number one, more buy-in, and two, the capability to defend against these threats as they kind of move out from the normal territories that they had been. They start spreading. This is why, both from a diplomatic and military cooperation perspective, it's so important that the United States engages in our allies in these different regions, and more importantly, creates that unified, defined front against them. It's certainly a multipolar and very complicated world, and the United States, to continue to maintain its security, has to engage in these different areas and has to invest both our dollars and as well as our time with our military training and working bilaterally, multilaterally with our partners abroad. I hope that now you got a better sense of how the Iran deal was formed, how it was never going to stop Iran from actually acquiring a nuclear weapon, how that it's now dying, and that it's important that as our adversaries abroad are now more aligned than ever, we continue to enhance those relationships to push back on these regional threats, especially countries that have no regard for human rights, individual liberty, or the freedom of its people. Thank you for joining me. I hope you enjoyed this episode. And as always, I hope you are picking up what I'm putting down. I am Matt Parker. This is Brief Before Impact.